This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Before we get to the Spirit and Place Festival, which is our topic today, we want to let you know about the big news that the Penske organization has agreed to purchase the Indianapolis Motor Speedway from the Holman family. In a statement released this morning, Roger Penske says, quote, "My passion for racing began at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in 1951 when I attended the Indianapolis 500 with my father. We have so much respect and appreciation for the history and tradition of the Speedway and the sport of IndyCar racing. I want to thank Holman and Company for the opportunity to build on this legacy, and it'll be an honor for Penske Corporation to help lead these great institutions forward into a new era," end quote. Listen for more on this big news from IMS on your Indiana Public Radio, public broadcasting station this afternoon on All Things Considered. All this week, the Spirit and Place Festival will put on a series of events around Indianapolis addressing a wide range of topics. Most of them will be discussions on social issues, but the way they'll be discussed is a little different from the usual drab academic lectures or fiery speeches made by impassioned activists. No, the Spirit and Place Festival encourages the creative community to step in and infuse art with ideas to make lasting impacts. This hour, we'll get a sampling of some of the big ideas that'll be discussed this week in Indianapolis. And we want to hear from you. How do you think social problems like these should be addressed? Do you agree with the creative approach Spirit and Place takes? Have you been to Spirit and Place in recent years? What did you think? Share your thoughts on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get them in front of our live panel today. Joining us in the studio is Director of Community Engagement for Spirit and Place, LaShonda Crowe-Storm. Thanks for coming.
Hello.
And putting on an event called Stuck, an Evening of Conversation in Film, is Louise Henderson from the Indianapolis Film Project. Good afternoon, Louise.
Good afternoon, Matt.
LaShonda, I was asked over the weekend what Spirit and Place was, and I don't think I did a very good job of explaining it because it's a lot of things, right? For those who don't know, what is the Spirit and Place Festival?
Well, it's a huge mashup of arts, humanities, and religion. Those are kind of our tools that we use as a vehicle to create space for experimentation, critical dialogue, to use this as a way to definitely build community collaboration and capacity building. And with that, you might find a really deep and intense discussion, which like we had on Sunday with a event called A Tailored Fit, which is really about what does it mean when you live in a society where everything about you is not societal norms. You might also have things like this weekend, super universal shapeshifters, where they used art to really delve into different spiritual practices. You can have events that are talking about history, because that is in humanities. We have a lot of events that, again, bring together religions. So today is a really interesting event called This Far by Faith, which we have different types of faith-based organizations, not all Abrahamic, coming together to really talk about how their faith journey has been the root of how they've led them, their congregations, to explore social justice issues.
How long has Spirit and Place been going on?
It is in its 24th year.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it had been going on that long.
It's been going on a couple decades now.
Put on by the Polis Center?
Yes, it's complicated. So Spirit and Place is what we consider a legacy project of the Polis Center at IUPUI School of Liberal Arts.
And things got started Friday evening with opening night at the Harrison Center. It goes through this Sunday. Mm-hmm. Did you get to see any of those talks that happened on Saturday and Sunday that you talked about?
Yeah, I actually was at the Tailored Fit discussion, and today I'll be working with the This Far by Faith as the community engagement director. My job is to really work with those organizations and groups that are new to the festival. Have also looked at what does their programming look like if it's outside of the festival, because we do year-round programming, as well as groups and organizations that have historically not considered the festival a place or a platform for them to explore the work that they'd like to do in community.
And of the ones that are still coming down the pike this week, what talks are you looking forward to at this year's festival?
See, now you're asking me to pick my favorites out of, and of course, these are all ones that I've worked very heavily with. But This Far by Faith, definitely, because just on my art hat, I'd work with some of the groups and really encourage them to come into the festival to really bring these discussions they've been having in their congregation to the forefront. of the community at large. I'm really looking forward to rites of passage. For the past 2.5 years, we've been doing work around formerly incarcerated men and women. This is a product of kind of working with some of the community groups, the Indiana Women's Prison Project, in the Inside Out program, but really working with individuals who have been inside to tell their stories, and then those stories will be performed on stage. So it's the stories, it's the performance of the stories. So I'm very much looking forward to rites of passage. I'm really looking forward to Solutions and S'mores because I love s'mores. And this, again, is an organization that we've worked with that specifically focus on women and incarceration. Spirituality at the intersections, I'm really interested in because, again, they bring together a lot of different faith traditions to really talk about what does it mean in this day and age. And I'm definitely looking forward to the public conversation this year, which is bringing Hannah Nicole Jones from New York, who was the lead author on the 1619 Project with the New York Times, to come to our community and talk with us.
Louise Henderson is helping put on Stuck, an evening of conversation and film, this coming Wednesday, starting at 5:30 at Spades Park Library. And this event revolves around a Bette Davis movie that I had never heard of. But now that I have, I really want to see it. Can you tell us about this movie and why you wanted to build a Spirit in Place event around it?
Yes. Well, we are new on the scene. Indianapolis Film Project is new. We're a new not-for-profit in town dedicated to enriching film culture and film art in the city, a piece of our cultural fabric that hasn't been filled. And we're building, actually, right across the street from the Spades Park Library, a four-screen cinema to show independent film year-round and a restaurant as well called The Brasserie. So a long way of answering your question, Matt, is that we wanted to do something that was evocative of film and conversation with our new friend across the street, Spades Park Library. The library manager, Deb Arrett, has just been so supportive of our project. So we found this movie from 1956. Bette Davis is the town librarian. And this is, of course, at the height of the McCarthy era, the fears of communism. And they want her to take just one simple book off the shelf in exchange for getting the children's wing that she's always wanted. And I'll tell you, watching this movie with 2019 eyes is so fascinating because really the more things change, the more they stay the same. So we're going to have a conversation around that, but getting away from strictly book censorship and looking more at where are we as a culture and a civilization stuck right now, with the theme being revolution and evolution. Well, I kind of think in some ways we're stuck. So we took that and then went to the point of, does art have any answers to help lead us out of this polarized position where we're isolated and tribalism and things like that have come in into the public conversation and we're not talking to each other? So I wondered if maybe art would. So we've got a wonderful lineup of panelists, Dan Wakefield, the author Dan Wakefield, Jennifer Delgadillo, who is she's got a great art background. She's organized the Wonderland Film Festival for the Inglewood neighborhood in the East Side. She's just a dynamo. Manon Voice, who is a poet and spoken word artist and activist. And then Julia Whitehead from the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. So we want those folks to help us in the audience process our thoughts about what is it like to be here today seeing similar issues that were happening in 1956, stoked by different types of fears.
Yeah. What do you think are the parallels that you see today that make this discussion worth having?
Yeah. So then it was communism. Now it's so many other issues. You know, we see people who traffic in conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories are just, it's if you put it out there, it gains some truth, even though there's no factual basis. We're seeing that so often. That was happening in the 50s. People are being villainized. People are being isolated, scapegoated. And we just aren't. We're smearing reputations of people who don't deserve it. I mean, we see this in our headlines every day. So as we see in the film, Bette Davis becomes the outcast in the community, and the whisper campaign that goes on about her gains legs and truth. And we see that today, you know, so that we are moving away from each other, not toward. So we are stuck. And that is where I hope that our panelists and our audience will help us think about ways that we can get that wheel of revolution going again and heal as a society and as a culture.
Do we know about how well this movie did in its time, or how many people have seen it since? Is this sort of a forgotten movie?
Yes, it is. First of all, it's a strange title, isn't it? Storm Center. It was not terribly well received. It was bold for its time in that it is the first movie out of Hollywood that took on the communist threat.
Because it was very much – Hollywood was very much under threat from McCarthyism.
You bet. In fact, Bette Davis was not the first actress mentioned as a possible cast member. Others backed out because of the fear of blacklisting or just at least being affiliated with a film that was taking on a very, very contentious and fearful topic of the time. So it was a brave film, but it didn't do that well. I have to thank Ben Sutphin, who is part of our Indianapolis Film Project team, for helping us find the film. And we watched it. It's on Amazon Prime. And we watched it and thought, oh, my goodness, this is just like the perfect basis for us to start from, because it has libraries and film, and it deals with so many of the same issues that we're struggling with as a culture today.
And I think perhaps, and we've only got about a minute left, but I think perhaps one of the most interesting things about this talk is what community you think might be able to help us out of this cycle. Who do you think might move us toward a solution?
Well, I'm just kind of wondering. It seems like if you look back in history, artists, people who think outside the box, who think differently, who look at things from a different perspective, might be able to propose some solutions that those of us in a more linear thinking way won't come to. So I have hope that perhaps it is art that will help bring us together and propose solutions that we aren't conceiving of yet as a culture and as a community.
She's presenting Stuck this Wednesday evening at Spades Park Library. They'll be watching and discussing the 1956 film Storm Center with representatives from the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library. Louise Henderson, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Matt.
And we'll hang on to Spirit and Place Director of Community Engagement, LaShonda Crowe-Storm, for our next segment. And coming up, our next guest has a background in addressing problems of infant and maternal mortality and thinks Indiana's high rates can be improved creatively through grassroots efforts. We want to hear from you. What do you think will make things better for moms and babies in at-risk communities in Indiana? Or if you or someone you know is part of that statistic and you're willing to share your story, please do so on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on this year's Spirit and Place Festival being held this week in Indianapolis, I want to tell you about our last show. We end every week with the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. We also talk to our health reporter, Jill Sheridan, about how music is being used to help dementia patients in Indiana. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In Indiana. We're back with Spirit and Places Community Engagement Director LaShonda Crowe-Storm, and joining us on the phone is Dr. Jack Turman. He's a professor at IUPUI's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health, and he's putting on an event for Spirit and Place called Herstory, a prenatal postpartum pop-up museum. Dr. Turman, welcome.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
Wonderful. And as always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We'll be talking about Indiana's high maternal and infant mortality rate and ways to combat it. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. So, Dr. Turman, can you give us the overview? What is this pop-up museum?
Sure. So thanks for having me on. So this Saturday at from 1 to 4 p.m. at Carriage House East Apartments, we will be hosting Herstory. And at this Spirit in Place Festival event, participants will come, and they will first learn all about our grassroots maternal and child health leadership initiative that is going on in Marion County as well as in Bartholomew County. And then they will learn about very important grassroots efforts around the world that have really worked to improve birth outcomes. All of us that are really focused on infant mortality reduction really need to recognize that to make significant changes in this really serious emotional and economic public health problem, we must embrace the women that are living in communities that have been historically impacted by this and persistently experience high infant mortality rates. We know from the global health sector that really making significant changes in birth outcomes is reliant upon listening to the voices of women who have experienced this or whose families have experienced this. We need to really look at this issue through their lens. And so at the Her Story event, participants will get to meet the women in Indiana that are going through the Grassroots Maternal Child Health Leadership Initiative, which I lead, which is funded by Riley Children's Foundation. So we're really grateful for that. And they'll learn about what the women are doing here in Indiana. And then, like I said, they'll break out into sessions to learn about famous grassroots efforts around the world. We'll focus on efforts in India, Uganda, South Africa, Somaliland, and then a really great program in Kansas City, Missouri. After that history moment, then all the participants will get to tap into their creative energies and work to create art that is representative of their feelings and their thoughts and their ideas about the prenatal period and or the postpartum period, and how important it is to have healthy communities in order to have healthy women and healthy babies and healthy families. So participants can either write poetry, they can paint, they can participate in oral storytelling, they can create mosaics, or they can crochet baby blankets. And when the time is up for the event, then we'll display all of these products that have been created, and our great partners at the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute, the film documentary project there, they're going to film everything and create a video that will go up on a website so that it'll be called Her Story, a prenatal postpartum pop-up museum, so that, then people can use this as a way to facilitate conversations about highlighting the voices of women to understand the root causes of poor birth outcomes.
And November is National Prematurity Awareness Month. Of course, it just also happens to be when Spirit in Place is held. Was choosing to do this now because of that sort of serendipitous convergence of those two things? What came first, the chicken or the egg?
As being really involved in the Indiana March of Dimes as the state maternal and child health chairperson of the committee, I should say, for MCH, It was just serendipitous, quite frankly, because March of Dimes does all these great events in November around National Prematurity Awareness Month. And it just so happened, you know, the Spirit in Place Festival event is happening at that time. So it all came together, to really be able to highlight, our infant mortality issues in Indiana. And you know, a major cause of infant mortality is preterm birth. And The March of Dimes has just released their maternal infant report cards. And again, Indiana scored very low, getting a grade of a C minus. And so it all comes together to just really we really need a dialogue with community members, especially women, to understand, you know, what's behind this. We have great healthcare systems, Matt. You know that. We have incredible physicians and nurses and nurse practitioners and social workers and great hospital systems. And yet this problem persists in our state. We're the seventh worst state in the union for infant mortality. We are worse than any of our neighboring states. And I really believe that we need to complement all the great work of the healthcare sector around this by really understanding from women in high-risk areas for infant mortality their perceptions of social, economic, and environmental root causes of the problem, but to understand their perspectives of how to address it. That's really important because you can invest a lot of money in a community to address a problem, but if it's not addressing what the citizens perceive and know as the root cause, then it's not an efficient use of funds. And so throughout my career, I've really learned to respect the wisdom and the skills and the knowledge of women in these communities because they have great insight into how to deal with it.
And
so
just,
that's what this is all about.
And this might sound a little pointed. I don't mean for it to. I want it to lead to a productive part of the discussion just to address what some of us might be thinking. Why are you, a white male, putting on this event, this pop-up museum about infant and maternal mortality in primarily minority populations? I understand that you have quite a background on this topic.
Yes, that's a good question. And that's totally fair. I get asked it all the time. Well, first of all, in all of my work around this, and I go into the communities and work with all these outstanding women and family members and citizens, I acknowledge that they are the experts in their community. They are the community discipline experts. We are to work in equitable partnership with each other to really address this issue. I understand, you know, I can help them and work with them by like exposing the data to them so that they understand the numbers and work with them to facilitate the strategies that they think would be useful. I think that saving the lives of babies and mothers is everyone's responsibility. And I genuinely believed throughout my whole career and my whole life and what I learned from my family, and every baby is valuable. Every baby has the potential to make a great positive influence on our world. And that we all need to be in this together, and that we shouldn't exclude anyone from working on these efforts. I completely acknowledge I'm not a woman. I'm not a person from a minority community, but I'm definitely willing to learn and work to learn from them and to work with them, and to help address this problem.
This has been an area of expertise of yours for a long time. I guess I want to know why this is so important to you. You've done a lot of this kind of work for a lot of different populations. How did it get started?
Well, I guess originally it got started because during my undergraduate education, I was actually trained as a physical therapist, and then I became a pediatric physical therapist working with indigent populations in Los Angeles and along the California-Mexico border. Individuals from those villages in northern Mexico would come into our hospital in Los Angeles where I worked, and I was just really moved by seeing the heartache of parents losing a baby, losing a child, and I got really frustrated by kind of the lack of that. There's an immediate, how do I say this? There's an immediate sorrow around it, and then it tends to go away, and people are expected to just move on, and it disproportionately affects, especially the African American communities in our country, and then in general people living in poverty, and that just always, it just really impact me, Matt, you know, to where I think it's really important that we give top priority to pregnant women and their babies. I went on to get, it kind of got more intense, my interest. I went on to get my PhD and did developmental neuroscience work and really began to understand how environment and influences early brain development and behavior development and attachment formation and really like transitioned to becoming someone who works out in communities to raise concern about this, to kind of rally people in communities to address this. We need to recognize that in every civilization and in every society, women and caring for a pregnant woman is critical to the health and well-being of our society, and making sure that every woman has the opportunity to have a very healthy, supported pregnancy, and that every baby has the chance and the opportunity to get a great start and to thrive is really important. I would say essential for the well-being of our society.
We're on the phone with Dr. Jack Terman. He's a professor at IUPUI's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. He's putting on an event for Spirit in Place called Her Story, a prenatal postpartum pop-up museum. And we're also here with LaShonda Crowe Storm, Spirit in Place's Director of Community Engagement. LaShonda, Indiana's maternal mortality rate, especially among minority communities, is an issue that's been in the news a lot. We've talked about it on this show a lot. Do the things that Jack is saying about it resonate with you in any way?
How do you mean? Do I know people who've lost children?
Well, yeah. Do you?
If
you do, then certainly that's relevant. But it just seems to me that this when this came in to our field of view, mm-hmm. it really surprised me that Indiana was having such a problem with maternal and infant mortality. But then again, as a white male, I had that perspective. I sort of had those blinders on, I suppose.
So yes, I do know people who've lost children, but I think the story that he tells is more of a wider issue about how black and brown lives are viewed in this country. So the notion that Indiana would be somehow in a bubble when we look at nationwide how those lives are valued from birth all the way to what happens in preschools when we see the black children and other brown children are the ones who are suspended and expelled from preschool. I'm not really sure what a three-year-old can do. So these types of conversations that we're seeing with her story allow us to also dive deeper into the issues that are at the core that some people's lives are not valued. And what does that mean? And do we have the courage to do what's necessary so that each one of those babies that he talks about is valued from cradle to grave?
She's the director of community engagement for the 2019 Spirit in Place Festival. LaShonda Crowe-Storm, thank you. We'll let you get back to your busy week. We appreciate you coming by.
No problem. Thank you.
And he's a professor at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI and organizing Her Story, a prenatal postpartum pop-up museum, Saturday afternoon at the Carriage House Apartments Community Center, part of this year's Spirit in Place Festival. Dr. Terman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being on. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Up next, how would the world react if we got the news that life had been found somewhere other than Earth? Specifically, how would the world's religions grapple with it? That's the question another Spirit in Place event hopes to address this week. Of course, we want to know what you think. Comment on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our preview of some of the events that will be featured at this year's Spirit in Place Festival going on all this week through this coming weekend all around Indianapolis. Creative discussions around big questions, including the very big question of how we might react if we found proof of life elsewhere in the universe. That'll be the discussion this coming Wednesday evening at the Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation. Gods, with S in parentheses. In other words, we could say God and aliens. Gods and Aliens, a conversation on faith, science, and E.T. And among the panelists will be local faith leaders and Dr. Gabe Filippelli, director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI School, IUPUI's Purdue School of Science. Dr. Filippelli, welcome back to All In.
Thanks for having me again.
And moderating that event will be our own Indiana Public Broadcasting health reporter and fill-in host for All In, Jill Sheridan. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much. Also science reporter, which is what makes me qualified.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly. LaShonda Crowe-Storm is still with us, and we want to hear from you. How do you think the world might react if we found out we're not alone in the universe? Would it be pandemonium, or might it usher in a new era of enlightenment? Comment on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Dr. Filippelli, how did you get roped into this big discussion?
Well, it, as most things as a professor, it came from students. I teach a class on life on other planets. And as part of that class, I'm really interested to hear about how students themselves conceptualize and frame the scientific understanding of something that is truly otherworldly with their own sort of faith-based underpinnings. Because we have to sort through your beliefs in life along with the facts that we're confronted. And there's no place, I think, where it becomes more challenging, in at least now, in this concept that we might not be alone in the universe. And so when you think about a lot of the scriptures on various faith-based communities, they are very Earth-centric. How do they accommodate there being life on many planets? Does the Bible accommodate maybe 4,000 different Jesuses who came up on other planets? Do the other faiths do similar kind of accommodation? So I think it's intriguing. And hearing the students talk about how they sort through how this discovery might change their own faith is really fascinating. So I thought, let's open up the discussion to other experts, including religious leaders and a professor of religious history.
Do you think science and faith do a good job of talking to each other?
No, they do a terrible job. Not only that, but I think science has been disconnected from society quite a bit. And that's one of my big passions is when we mentally disconnect science and scientific facts from the reality of how we live our lives. We see this on issues like climate change, on evolution, which is one of the themes of this year's Spirit in Place Festival. It keeps us from having intelligent dialogue and conversation about really important issues.
Yeah. So in what ways have I think faith can also be disconnected from society in a certain way, too, right?
Sure.
And so what about this question of how the world might change if we found life outside of Earth? How would it shake up your work?
Well, it's interesting. I assume we will find it. Most astrobiologists think that we're about 20 to 30 years away from finding proof of life on other planets, whether that be Mars or we have these new space hunting telescopes where we've now discovered there's thousands of potentially habitable planets right nearby our own Earth. Not only that, we can even look at their atmospheres. And there's a finding last week that we saw a planet that is about our size, maybe a little bit bigger, that has liquid water in its atmosphere. So it looks just like Earth. So for me, I expect that to happen. You know, and the question is, are we going to have one of these Copernican revolutions where Copernicus said, oh, by the way, the Earth is not the center of the universe, it's nor even of our solar system, or Darwin and the theory of evolution? Where it's like, you know, it's not 6,000 years old. It's actually about 4 billion years old and life has slowly evolved. These findings are really unsettling to people in their own faiths.
Yeah, we've already gotten pretty close. The Curiosity rover discovered complex organic molecules on Mars. Cassini found the same thing flying by Enceladus, a moon of Saturn. You think we're there within 20 to 30 years?
I think undoubtedly. I mean, we are sending right now a specific rover to Mars that's designed specifically for capturing signatures of life. And the question will be, of course, if we find life there, did it evolve separately from life on Earth? Or have we seeded each other? We get hit by meteorites all the time. We find pieces of Mars all the time on Earth. Mm. And similarly, pieces of Earth are on Mars. So we could have very easily fertilized the entire solar system. We might be Martian.
So if we find it literally next door, I guess, in Mars, which is quite a ways away, but again, we're close enough to be affected by each other. Would that then be proof that it could exist elsewhere, probability-wise?
It certainly would be. When you find it more than one place, you think, well, it's probably pretty common. And most people who actually go through the dynamics of how the early Earth looked like, it looked just like early Mars and just like early Venus. We just got lucky in the sense that we have the right kind of geology to continue harboring life for 4 billion years. We've had life for 4 billion years on this planet. We've been assaulted by all kinds of crazy stuff. yet here we persist.
Jill, you're the moderator this Wednesday. These are really big questions.
Yeah.
We're all kind of giggling in here because this is sort of over everything. Do you have any expectations as to how this discussion is going to go?
Well, I really want to dig in more into, you know, the history. Like you said, you know, what happened when, you know, Darwin's, the science that he presented really became concrete and became accepted. You know, how did that change religions? What different religions changed their thoughts, and how did we morph and become more accepting of facts? Those are the kind of things that I'm pretty interested in hearing about from the panelists and from the audience as well. You know, looking at the history to understand what we might expect when we do discover life beyond Earth.
And what will this evening look like? I understand there'll be a big talk and then some small group discussions as well. Do you know how that's going to go?
Yeah, Gabe was just telling me, thank goodness. There's a large panel discussion, and then he's going to have everybody break into small groups, which I think will be a great moderated small groups, which will be able to then have people sort of coalesce their thoughts and opinions on the talk, and then we'll bring those ideas back, and we'll be able to talk largely to the panelists then about the reactions to the talk that we're having.
Dr. Filippelli, can you talk about how faith has wrestled with new discoveries in science before? We talked about Darwin. We touched briefly on heliocentrism. How have different faiths historically moved through that? It's not a real pretty history.
No, it's not. And some have proven to be a little bit more flexible just from the formation of Buddhism and Hinduism, for example. They've actually already built in these concepts of the fact that we are not necessarily alone in vague terms, but nevertheless, they're built in there, as opposed to the Judeo-Christian traditions, which tend to be pretty earth-centric in their formation. So here's an example. certainly Copernicus, Galileo, they were vilified at that time both in the Protestant and Catholic churches. And so it's been really difficult. But I'll tell you, even in my own field, where I take for granted that the Earth is very old, because it simply is, and when I've had students or confronted students where they'll say, well, even in their papers, they'll write, well, I personally know the Earth is only 6,500 years old. Nevertheless, for the purpose of this class, I will answer your question.
You see papers like that?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So this is still very much going on now, and this is why I think these dialogues are just so critical.
Well, how then could you – I mean, you want to be careful not to challenge someone's faith by saying, you really believe that, or maybe asking why. How do you approach that, and how often do you get things like that in papers? Once a year? Once every couple of years?
More on the once a year side, and yeah. I think probably there's more students who believe that who are too embarrassed to put it in their papers.
Mm-hmm.
And the very fact that we have this creation museum nearby in Kentucky, mm-hmm. and this ark tells you that's not a rare phenomenon, especially in some parts of the United States. And so my response is not to beat them over the head. I find that people who have a deeply held faith are not necessarily convinced by more science, more facts. I mean, this is true about climate change. This is true about these kinds of issues. But, you know, I simply pursue the scientific line and try to see if I can – if I find some kind of common ground. For example, even those people with very strong opinions about the length – the supposed length of time that the Earth has been around are usually open at least to discussing observations that they see in the modern planet. So we do talk about things like climate change and those observations they've seen in their own lifetime and their parents' lifetime. And particularly, I ask students to interview their grandparents about what was weather like when you were young. And that usually gets across a point that, oh, climate change has already happened in my own two generations. So the Earth does change.
We're talking with Dr. Gabe Filippelli. He will be on the panel of the Spirit in Place event, Gods and Aliens, a conversation on faith, science, and ET. Moderating that event will be Jill Sheridan, our science reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We're also joined by LaShonda Crow Storm, who is the Community Engagement Director for Spirit in Place. Dr. Gabe, do you think that the possibility exists that science might jump the gun and just simply deduce the probability is high enough to assume that there's life elsewhere? Or is that not really how science works? You have to have concrete evidence first.
No, you can certainly have scenarios. So like whenever you pose a hypothesis, for example, you are making some educated guesses, right, about how the world works. And then you pursue those guesses by trying to find facts. And if enough of the facts line up with your guesses, it becomes a theory. Hence, the theory of evolution is not some crackpot scheme that can be overturned quickly by, you know, somebody on Twitter, for example, who brings up some false fact. It's actually built on a whole foundation, a solid foundation of scientific facts. This point of concept that we think we are not alone in the universe is similarly actually built up on a relatively stable footing of observations, but never to this point have we actually seen life on another planet. So for now, if you ask a scientist, they'll say, we're pretty sure we'll find something soon. But for now, the only solid evidence is that we are alone in the universe. To some people, they hear that and they say, oh, a scientist said we're alone in the universe. No, that's not what the scientist
that's
said.
That's just what the evidence tells us.
Exactly.
Jill, this is a delicate topic, but it's really kind of a fun one. Obviously, we're having a lot of fun with it. How did you get involved in this?
I mean, Gabe asked me.
Okay.
It's really, really interesting, though, because especially I think in the climate that we are in today where, you know, people are questioning science and the importance of fact to be able to understand, you know, how these facts and how science works and relates to religion. I think it's just a really cool time to be having this topic.
I've seen the guest list.
Well.
Dr. Gabe is going to be there. He's a civil guy, a calm guy, a heady guy.
Yeah.
And I've seen the rest of the people that are going to be there. It seems like a really civil group. But what if it goes off the rails?
I'm sure it won't, Matthew. I'm sure that it will be a civil discussion. If it does go off the rails, then, I mean, it just shows how passionate people are about this topic. And if people in the audience, you know, get a little crazy, then I think, you know, that's fine, because it is a really big, like you mentioned, but also important topic to be having at an important time.
LaShonda, is this a typical event for Spirit in Place, would you say?
Oh, yeah.
It is? You deal with big questions all the time.
This is Spirit and Taste gold mine here. I would just say, as a person who does not practice any of the Abrahamic faith traditions, to just be really clear and provide other examples, because, as you said, lots of other faith traditions aren't rooted in this notion that, because, you know, Spirit in Place is about the arts, humanities, and religion, aren't rooted in this notion that the earth is it. Lots of, especially when we look at indigenous traditions, are very clear that we have a human experience on this planet only, and there's some other stuff. We don't know what it is because we're not out there in it, and so... other faiths won't be, so I can't believe there's other life on the planet that'll be more like, we told you we had some cousins out there somewhere, so now we get to maybe meet them because maybe they've been hiding, because there's been life on the earth for a very long time, but until human beings arrived, that's questionable if we continue on this course, if life will be here in 100 years or so. So that's a different question in regards to what does it mean when a faith tradition is already grounded in the notion that we are but one drop in all of the universe. So what does that mean to see the beauty of all creation in all its various ways? And what does that mean?
There's people, religions that are based more in spirituality.
No, there's based on different facts that there is other life, that is a core principle, that there's other life, and this is just a human experience.
Or the acceptance of possible future facts.
No, like literally, at the core of the faith is that we know that there's other life. We're just here, and what does it mean for you to just be here? And what does that human experience then mean that you're here? Because this is some rough stuff on this planet. So maybe there's some good stuff elsewhere, but this is some rough stuff outside these doors, and that's a different discussion when we have to start thinking about that. That maybe other life knows we're here, and they're making sure we don't get off this planet. So,
Dr. Gabe, we talked about some of the things you've heard from some of your students. We got about a minute left. Are there sort of patterns in the types of questions that you hear from your students on this topic when it's discussed?
I think the most consistent pattern is that they had no idea about, first of all, how resilient life has been on this planet, and how likely it is that there are many planets out there with life and with the conditions even suitable for us. I think the most mind-opening issue that we bring up is one that LaShonda just mentioned, is that we have now signaled our existence past about 200 different solar systems which have planets on them. So we've already said inadvertently, we're here.
You're talking about radio signals?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And there is a very open question of, if someone heard that message, would they even respond?
Dr. Filippelli, Dr. Gabe Filippelli, director of the Center for Urban Health at IUPUI's Purdue School of Science. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
And good luck on the talk this coming Wednesday evening. Jill Sheridan, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks.
If you're interested in catching the conversation, Gods and Aliens, a conversation on faith, science, and ET, you can attend the talk on Wednesday night at 6:30 at the Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation. And you can find more details on the Spirit in Place Festival at spiritinplace.org. A lot of interesting talks and activities that you can find there now through November 10th. LaShonda Crowe-Storm, Community Engagement Director for Spirit in Place, thank you for joining us this hour as well.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, get it wherever you find podcasts. Join us tomorrow and we'll talk about the talent shortage in Indiana. We'll be joined by experts in policy and workforce initiatives to discuss the factors that have contributed to workforce shortages that many companies are facing today and how the state can adapt. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And we're back tomorrow at this time for that conversation. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.